Welcome to the second part of our two-part episode featuring Joel Presby and David Weber talking about their new book and many other things. Also in this part, John, Jeff, and I will discuss our culture consumed for the month of January. Sit back and enjoy the show.
Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
I killed a character in Mutineer's Moon. And Sharon was, at that point, she was working in the Walden bookstore here in Greenville. She was, I'd only known her for, oh gosh, 6-7 months at that point. And I had told her, cute little redhead, I go in to buy a book and science fiction. And she comes over and says, did you read this? You might like this. I've already read it. You might like that one. Already read it. You might like this one. Already read it. You might like this one. Ooh, haven't read that one. And so we were talking, and then I said to her, I've written a book, you know. Now, one does not normally think of, I've written a book, you know, as a pickup line. But then one is not normally a cute redhead working in a bookstore. Okay. So she was like, wait, I think my manager's calling. You know, kind of. The next time I came in, I brought her the manuscript for Mutineer's Moon. And she was like, oh. And so she started reading it. And about 2 weeks later, I walked in, and I'm talking to the manager of the store, and all of a sudden this stripped paperback comes flying across like four aisles and hits me in the back of the head. And I turn around, and she says, you killed Sean! What? Well, yeah, no, you didn't just kill him. You had him, like, torn apart by a grab gun. And I said, well, yeah, it was kind of like shooting the hero's dog in a Chuck Norris movie. Oh, that didn't go over well. I told her later, I said, look, I named his nephew for him. Heck, I even gave him an entire continent-sized nature preserve on the capital planet of the Empire. And she says, you killed
him. He still killed him.
He's still dead, you know. And I'm like, I'll have to do an alternate universe somewhere, you know, at least not. But, yeah, it is, it's hard killing characters. I mean, people might not think that given how many I've killed, but if you compare me to John Ringo, you know, I mean, Eric Flint actually pierced my mask several years ago. He said, you know, the real trick to David is he doesn't kill that many of the characters that are main central characters, but he builds his secondary characters well enough that when he kills them, you think he just killed a major character.
Hmm.
And I said, ooh, I must dissemble better than that.
Told on you.
Yeah, but it's true. And sometimes I do kill a major character, and sometimes it's very hard. When I killed Andrew La Follette.
Ooh, I haven't forgiven you for that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I tell you the truth. I wrote that chapter about 6 times trying not to kill him, and the book didn't work. I really tried very hard not to kill him, and the book didn't work. And it wasn't until I finished the rough draft and sent it off that I realized why. And there really is a reason for it, Fred. I just didn't know what it was. Honor loses 98% of her family in Sphinx in the Iwata strike.
Mm-hmm.
But you've never actually met them. You knew Miranda. Okay? You knew Andrew. And so you can extrapolate from what you know that cost her to understand what the rest of it cost her. And without that, for all that Honor might have shown grief in the book, from the reader's perspective, it would have been an almost antiseptic grief. You see what I'm saying?
Right. Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that I feel very strongly about, and Joelle and I talked about this even before, just as Bu 9, we talked about this before we ever started the Road to Hell. If you're going to write military fiction, you have certain moral obligations, as I see it. Because for all we talk about what a violent society we are, the average American's personal experience with violence is very limited compared certainly to other places on the face of the planet. And that means that we formulate our concept of what violence is and the consequence of violence vicariously. From what we see on the news, what we see in the movie, what we read, we're internalizing someone else's experience without directly experiencing it ourselves. And I think, therefore, that if you're going to write military fiction and you're going to have violence in it, you need to show the consequences of the violence, the cost of the violence, to not sanitize it, to not make it glamorous without saying, yes, this takes courage, it takes magnificent determination, selflessness, all those things, but look at the price that gets paid, and not just by the people who choose to be the warriors. You have to do that. And that means, among other things, that people that you care about die. The person who, in some ways, was the most painful death for honor was actually Alistair McKeon. Which nobody would have bet on the day they first met on HMS Fearless. But one of the reasons that it hurt her so much was that she wasn't even there when it happened. I've talked to a lot of military and ex-military. And one thing that several of them said to me was, the worst thing about combat is your friend was there at chow call and gone at noon. And, like, one of the guys I was talking to at, we had a little local book fair here in Greenville. The Anderson County Library actually had it. And while I was there, this guy turned up and he said, I've always really loved the Apocalypse Trope. And I said, well, I've liked it too. And he said, I flew with the 143rd in Vietnam and I was shot down. And I spent 2.5 years in Hanoi before I came home again. And he had brought me one of the ball caps from his group, which I made him sign before he gave it to me. It meant a lot to me that that book meant a lot to him, if you see what I'm saying.
Right.
But the other thing was that I said to him, you know, I knew a guy who was on the America, and who said, you know, the thing was they didn't lose bunches and bunches of guys. But somebody who had been there, you know, flying intruders or whatever, you know, he goes out and he doesn't come back and you don't know what happened. He's just gone. And that just leaves a friend-shaped hole in your life that you have to cope with somehow. And that's one of the things that I've tried to do with the characters in my books. I had a close friend who was Special Forces, and he told me one time, he said, you know, the second worst moment in a combat officer's life is when you've practiced the mission, your intel was good, you've practiced it, all the rehearsals went perfectly, you carry out the operation, everyone performs flawlessly, and you still have a 19-year-old bleeding out in your arms, and you cannot possibly put the life back into him. And I said, that's the second worst moment in your life? And he says, yeah. And I said, what's the worst? And he said, realizing that this is what you do best in all the world. And there's an element of that in honor. Yeah, I mean, I hope you can see it in there sometimes, that she really, in a lot of ways, hates what she does, but she does it so well. And if she steps aside, then somebody who doesn't do it as well will have to do the same job. One of the reasons that I wrote Beauty and the Beast in the Beginnings anthology, where I think of it as the courtship of Honor's daddy, okay, was... Because, well, what can I say? Honor has, you know, reflected on many occasions on the fact that she could have been a monster if things were a little bit different, if she hadn't found the right place to focus, you know, who she was and what she was. And here's her father, who is this big, giant, sheltering tree in her life that you've seen, you know, and who's like the guy, the one who puts his head down in his wife's lap and cries when they see the footage of Honor's supposed execution, you know, kind of thing. And now you see the other side of him in this story, and you understand why he became a doctor and so forth. To me, he's an indication of somebody who paid the price for combat and for being really good at it and decided that he was afraid of where it would take him.
Hmm.
And so he chose to go a different direction. And I've known people like that. And to me, the stories, I mean, okay, I love building the world. I love this. I love that. I love the other. But to me, ultimately, the stories are about the characters. And if a story's not about the characters, it's not going to work. And Joelle and I talked about that a lot while we were working on Road to Hell. And I really like, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, Joelle, the Simeon ambassador. You know who I'm talking
Sulan
about.
Sulan Chang, yeah. Rahul.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, the first time that we meet him, and he's poking holes in coconuts for the chimps, Joelle did this whole thing about why he's not still in the army and whatnot, and I thought, okay, she knows how to do this. That you build the character, and you don't have to tell the reader every single thing about him. But you have to have that grasp of who he is. And you have to let the reader far enough inside to realize that this is a real person. And I loved what you did, Joelle, with the freight yard employees who are talking about him when he's not there.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that scene.
Yeah, well, and you further fleshed out the character, even though he never says a word in the entire scene. Because you are absolutely seeing him through the eyes of these other guys.
And he wouldn't have been able to say what they said because he doesn't see himself the way other people do.
Absolutely. Very few people do. And it was a really good, I'm going to use the word device, but I mean it in the best possible sense of the word, literary device. It was a very good device for getting that across. And it really worked. I liked, I can tell I'm tired. I'm losing names. Darcel's wife. The pretty.
Alizon.
Alizon, yes. When she meets Shalar's mother.
Alizon Yanimar.
Yes. And that was a Joelle scene, where Shalar's mother turns up and Alizon is thinking, you know what, I better call security. She's here to murder me. You know, because that's what she's thinking initially. And then she realizes that she has totally misread this woman, except for the fact that she is just as driven as Alizon thought she was. And that's something that it's kind of like being tall in basketball. Okay, you can't teach someone height. All right, and I think you can't teach someone the ability to grasp that this is what goes in to making the character work and making the character accessible to the reader without beating the reader over the head with internal perspectives. One of the things that Honor Harrington has never quite grasped.
David, I'm really jealous of Honor. She has the tree cats.
Yeah.
She's gotta help.
Not only does she understand. not only does she have the tree cat, look at that metabolism I gave.
Yeah.
I had a friend of one of my, the wife of one of my friends say, I hate you. I said, why? And she said, because Honor can eat peach cobbler and wash it down with hot chocolate and not get fat. I was like, would you really wash peach cobbler down with hot chocolate if you could? And she said, yes. So I was like, okay, you are a sick puppy. Yeah. But it's, you know, Honor doesn't grasp the fact that she's catalytic in building outstanding officers. She really and truly, she didn't grasp that for the longest time. And she finally has sort of gotten a clue in that respect. But what was interesting to me was the number of readers who didn't pick up on the fact that if you go back and look at what Honor accomplishes, okay, 80% of it maybe is accomplished by other people who she's motivated rather than directly by her. And I'm like, guys, yeah. But I also have to admit, there's a scene in, which book is it in? It's the one where, it's War of Honor, where she's teaching at the academy, and she has Mike Hinkey over for her dinner that she has with some of her students, and Mike critiques her Cerberus strategy. And she winds up at the end of it by saying, in short, if it wasn't the most all or nothing, risk it all on one throw of the dice, no way back, you know, reckless strategy ever devised by a human being, I'm not aware of what was. Okay, and Honor looks at it and says, well, that's fair, you know, kind of thing at the end of it. Because Honor did it, therefore it must have been brilliant. Okay, well, Honor did it, and it was brilliant, and it was incredibly stupid. It just worked.
Right.
And people, they don't see the mistakes that she makes because she's Honor Harrington and because competent people make competent mistakes. In Echoes of Honor, actually in Honor Among Enemies, no, in Enemy Hands, when they bust her out of the brig, okay, two of her armsmen die. Andreas Venizelos, who's been with her since the first book, dies. Member of her staff, who's trying to get her out, dies. The only person who's left who was in the group that broke her out of the brig is Andrew LaFollette. She's in the intership car. She's saying, come on, Andrew, come on, Andrew. And he's rendered unconscious by a grenade explosion. She doesn't know whether he's alive or he's dead. And she knows, because they've told her, that McKeon and the others have seized the boat and they're holding it, waiting to escape the ship for her to get there. She's a stead holder. She's an admiral. She has all these responsibilities. She's got all these people waiting for her down there. All of that, she should have pressed the button and gone. She should have. It was her responsibility to do that, her duty to do that. And she can't do it.
Do you want to give us any sneak peek on the current novel you're working on, David, or is it all close hold?
It's been tough because of where it fits and where it goes. It's currently up to about 300,000 words, of which I'm going to go back and probably remove close to a third or more that it turns out I don't need because I'm dealing with the Talbot Quadrant, the Mike Hinkey storyline, although Mike has practically doesn't appear anywhere in the book. And the problem is that there's an element there that I've got to cover that's essential for the story, but I only have like 2 months to play with between the end of Shadow of Freedom and where this book needs to end. And so what I did is I went all the way back to Shadow of Saganami. And there are elements that I'm picking up from earlier and weaving together to build the events that are going on in these 2 months, if you see what I'm saying. They're like the backstory for it.
Right.
And that was hard because I had to go back to like 6 books. It was almost, Joelle, it was almost as bad as what I needed to do for Road to Hell. Not quite, but almost. And I had to build, go back and add more entries to my timeline calendar and so forth. I didn't keep one of those for the longest time, but now it has, like, I think starting with, probably Echoes of Honor. It has every major event in all of the novels in one consolidated timeline.
Nice.
Yes, and it is, like, very long. But when I do a book, I go through and I drop into that calendar. This is where that happens. This is where that happens. And then I write it and work my way through.
Right.
And, somewhat to my surprise, in many ways, the protagonist of this novel is Damien Harahap, otherwise known as Firebrand, ex-Solarian gendarme, now working for the Mason Alignment. And I really found myself liking him. Okay. Eventually, of course, the wheels come off for him, which is unfortunate. It has to happen.
Yes.
But I also have a planet full of Poles and a planet full of Czechs, who are involved in, Operation Janus, which is the Mason Alignment's operation to blame Manticore for all this stuff. And I have Scotty Tremaine and Horace Harkness take center stage for the primary military naval engagement in this one, and do an absolutely brilliant thing that I'm not going to tell you what it is, but the Terran admiral on the other side is like, oh, crap. You know, as soon as this happens, he's like, we are so screwed, you know. And what he doesn't realize is that the whole reason that Scotty has put together the strategy and the tactic that he's using is to avoid killing all the Solarians. Okay. He's got to convince them to fight the battle his way, because if he can't convince them to fight the battle his way, he's going to have to kill them all to keep them from getting away. it's like, guys, I know you won't believe this, but it's for your own good. But I do plan. Should I tell them what I'm planning on doing in 2018, Joel?
Taking a year off?
No.
Somehow I don't think so.
All right. Let's put it this way. If everything works properly, on my 20th anniversary and the 25th anniversary of the release of On Basilisk Station, I will bring the storyline that began with On Basilisk Station to a conclusion. Hmm. And in theory, I will have completed a series. Okay? And yes. The world will be amazed. But that's one reason why this book that I'm doing has to be where it goes.
Right.
Okay? Hmm. And that doesn't mean it's going to be the end of the Honorverse. It doesn't even mean it's going to be the end of Honor Harrington stories. Okay. But it's going, and in this, Honor will get to deliver the best line Honor Harrington has delivered yet. And I won't tell you what it is. But it's going to be right up there beside oops. And why do people like you always think you're more ruthless than people like me?
What about you, Joel?
Well, I've got a much easier job than David, which is good because I have much, much less experience. I'm writing my first solo novel.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to Bain, I've got a contract for it and one more. I'm 38,000 words in and probably about 12,000 until the storyline is done. And from what I've learned with writing with David is I write very skeletally at first.
Mm-hmm.
And the first draft, of course, is not something I share with anybody else. But then once the story's there, then I can put in the detail that belongs and flesh out the characters properly so that somebody else reading it knows who these people are and not just me.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm nearing the end of the story and I'm excited about it. It's
so you're gonna be looking at
science fiction within the solar system. And I'm not ready to reveal much more than that because too many things can change.
Yes. Well, and you're looking at 50,000 before you go back and begin further development on the characters in the scene? Because that sounds about right.
Yeah.
You know, having worked through Road to Hell with you.
Yeah. Well, I kept pretty careful notes to try to, you know, make the working with David be a paid writing internship as well. How am I doing this? What am I doing that works? What isn't working for me at this time?
Mm-hmm. You know,
you're already a graduate level professor, David. You just didn't realize it.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that that I greatly enjoyed this project. There have been a couple of collaborations that I have enjoyed less than others, and one that was not so minor disaster, although it ended quite well. Working on this project was exhausting in some ways, but the exhaustion had nothing to do with my writing partner. It had to do with what we needed to accomplish in the book, and where I had to go in retrieving the world that had been built and then put on the shelf for, I guess, 9 years for me. Mm-hmm. I think 7 years for the readership and 9 years for me. And that's hard to do after almost 10 years. And working with Joelle, let's put it this way. I can think of people working with whom would have added to the problems rather than detracting from them. Okay. and that was not a factor here. I think that the fact that Joelle and I had already worked together on The Companion and on Bew 9 and on the Grayson short stories that she had done.
Had clear roles and understood what we were expecting from the other and what we were getting into.
Yeah, that certainly helped. It's a collaboration is always a discovery process as well. No matter how well you know the other person, no matter how well you know what's going in, it's a discovery process, and that's good. That's one of the things you want it to be. And in Joelle's case, I can't really think of any discoveries that were unhappy ones. And that, to be honest, is a little rare in collaboration, to not have anything where you're – the one thing that I wanted to beat her over the head about occasionally was the combination of the sparseness in some of the scenes and the way that she would occasionally beat herself over the head about a scene that we were working on that wasn't quite coming together or whatever. I would much rather work with somebody who pushes themselves than somebody who says, you know, let George do it. But Joelle sometimes I felt was being unfair to herself in the way that she was responding to some of the stuff that where it wasn't coming together or where it was like, I think we need to go back and rethink that. I remember, I can't remember exactly which passage it was, Joelle, but I said, you know, like, well, we need to go back and rethink this. You were like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. You know, what was I thinking? I'm like, no, the problem wasn't that you shouldn't have done that. The problem is that what you did led me to reconsider the best way to approach that section of the book. And that's exactly the thing that I do myself when I'm going through and I go, oh, wait, this works, but it would work even better if. But you were like, oh, I messed up. I'm like, no, you didn't mess up. Okay, no,
David,
okay.
I don't know if I ever told you this, but in working with you at The Road to Hell, I had an epiphany about my editing process.
Yeah.
That I, before this book, when I found a thing I didn't like, I would delete the page and start over.
Uh-huh.
And through learning from you, I learned to, no, I can, whatever it is, I can work with it and I can revise it. I don't have to.
And you're married to the guy who can retcon anything. okay? What were you thinking?
And I think
yeah.
on that, because yeah. we promised very firmly to not, I mean, I could sit here all night and listen to you, but we promised very firmly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's great. That's...
Thank you very much for having us.
Yes.
I appreciate and my two colleagues appreciate
mm-hmm.
time, believe me. And I look forward to many more collaborations.
Thank you.
We're planning on at least two.
Yes.
Good.
And then of course, the problem is going to be that she's going to be out there writing all those solo novels, and she won't have time to work with me anymore.
Well, hopefully I can still do anthologies and stuff with you at least.
All right, that'll work.
Okay.
All right,
thank you very much.
Thank you, bye.
Thank you.
And once again, thanks to David and Joelle. I hope you all enjoyed that interview. Certainly, we enjoy just letting David run with it. And letting Joelle try to get a few words in edgewise. So now we're ready to move to Culture Consumed. This portion of the show will be just us three. Because I think you guys heard David enough. Just kidding, David. So, gentlemen, did you get any reading or anything done this month?
A little.
Would you like to go first, John?
Apparently, I've just volunteered.
No. I can go. No problem.
No, it's all right. I don't have a lot, so it's okay. Oh. Yeah, just not as much time to read this month for various reasons. I did read a couple of graphic novels that were not very good.
Ooh, which ones?
I read Midnighter Volume 1.
Oh, good lord. Oh.
And I read Batgirl Volume 2, the new Batgirl. And I almost stopped reading that when, spoiler alert, we find out that Jim Gordon is the new Batman, basically.
Yeah. As part of this whole weird...
And, you know, I was like, are you effing kidding me?
Jim Gordon is in Commissioner? Or
yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
It's a long story, and you got to keep in mind there's, like, what, 12 different Bat books right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, Bat books are everywhere, but I'm, you know, I just still walked away unsatisfied, even with a new writer. It was sort of the tone was not, I was hoping for a different tone from the first volume of the new stuff. And the tone was a little different. It's a little more crime fighter-y. She's a little more like Barbara Gordon and not a teeny bopper. But there was just a lot missing for me. And it just wasn't super inventive, and it honestly felt like other events in the, you know, Batverse were kind of dragging it down.
Yeah.
Because she just can't be Batgirl.
Yeah.
And, you know, Batgirl works best when she's just Batgirl. I mean, she really does work better as sort of a solo character, or a character essentially running her own crew. So, it was not pleasing. And then I read Midnighter Volume 1 out. And it's very mixed. I like that they're trying to, you know, work with his sort of background. They're trying to work with his background. And they're trying to work, you know, with his sexuality. But he's just so psychotic that everything just constantly goes off the rails, and it actually creates a chaotic undertone that does not enhance the story, but fragments it. So even though there's a very solid, you know, tried and true arc here, which is him recovering bioweapons from the God Garden, it's so sort of confusingly presented, and the art too is unfortunately really confusing, that I just had a hard time getting into it, and it was sort of a chore to get to the end. Although I like the idea, the fact that he explains his powers every single time. Detail starts to get old after, you know, 7 or 8 encounters. He literally almost stops and says, "I have already figured out all of your moves because I have a computer in my head and I am the Midnighter! Ha ha!"
Yes.
Like, yay, that's so stupid.
It became very much like the Tick after a while. So.
But it's not. It's not. It's supposed, yeah. It's in a sense supposed to be serious. So it's like, you know, all the intentional comedy, none of, you know, the stuff we like about Midnighter. So those were not things I enjoyed.
They also, I wasn't happy with that book because they kind of, they scaled him back quite a bit. This was that's a character who pretty much almost exclusively, I mean, he was the linchpin of the whole Warren Ellis widescreen movement when Wildstorm mm-hmm. really sort of broke open, and mm-hmm. he was kind of the he was the moral center, but he was probably the center of agency when it came to that kind of stuff of, you know, getting the
sure.
Getting the job done.
Sure.
He had had a miniseries earlier, right around that time, and there had been a couple other books mm-hmm. that he had been in, and even then they tended to keep him somewhat centered, but turning it into a full blown urban superhero as they did during the course of this just didn't mm-hmm. scaling it back that much was kind of a bit too abrupt for me.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha. Yeah, just he is someone who's created for a much larger story than the one that he's in. So that may have been a factor too, quite honestly. So not great. But I do appreciate being able to read these in advance for free, even if I can't keep them because, you know, I know what to avoid in the future. And, you know, Batgirl, I just really want some other Batgirl to come back. It doesn't have to be Gail Simone's Batgirl, but it would be nice to have a Batgirl who sort of felt like the complex person that Barbara Gordon is as a character. And who is super good at her job. I mean, like, she's almost second to Batman in terms of skills.
Yeah.
You know, that's the Barbara Gordon that works for me. And, you know, that's just not what we've been getting the last couple of volumes in the new arc. So those are the comics. I read 2 books. One was a reread. I reread Watership Down, which is a book I have not read for 26 years.
My wife just did the same thing a little while ago.
I haven't read it since, well, longer than that.
Uh-huh. And, Paul Jessup was talking about it at one point, and we were sort of comparing notes about its effect on us, and it seemed like a good time for a reread, so I reread it, and, you know, I was not as enamored of it as I was when I was younger, but I feel like I appreciated it more because, despite, you know, the subject matter and the cruelty and sort of unexpected violence, maybe, you know, rabbits, the fierce rabbit world.
Mm-hmm.
It's taught me, I think when I was younger, it just taught me a lot about story and I found it very useful to think about when I was writing. And now I think I appreciate the story more. And it's easier for me to admire what Adams did. And that just made me enjoy it more. So that was a nice reread to take.
Have you read his other books and more recently? Or
The only thing I've read of his is The Plague Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, even more heartbreaking than Watership Down.
Yeah.
And No, I just recently learned that he has like a book of short stories and a few other things. So I will hunt them down and on and partake of them as well.
Well, there's a short story collection set in the world of Watership Down.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Shardik, which was out of print for a real long time. I'm not even 100% sure if that's in print at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the, I guess, fantasy world with the bear gods or the talking bears or mm-hmm. something. I haven't, again, that was like middle school or high school. That was a big, big book being passed around at that time.
Right.
Hmm.
Interesting.
And then there's the movie. Either of you ever see that?
Oh, yeah.
I saw the movie before I read the book.
Okay.
And then there, so,
might have as well. I don't recall.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw the movie because a friend had gotten his mother to get it out of, you know, the video store because it was a cartoon.
Oh.
And, you know, I'm sure it's a cartoon about rabbits. There it's a bunny go. Movie. What could happen in a bunny movie? Evolution? Bloody revolt? Tyranny? Sexism? Needless death? Gods who are enigmatic, and you know, a crazy seagull.
Yes. yes.
We were really startled. Exactly. We were really startled when we saw it, and then we immediately watched it again. And it was sort of a cool, you know, it was sort of the cool movie in my little clique for a while. But it was nice to go back to the book. I do want to hunt down the movie at some point and watch it again too, but that was well worth rereading.
It's also a movie of the Plague Dogs, which
I have heard.
I'm not even 100% sure if it ever made it to the US.
I don't know. But that would be interesting to see too.
And I remember the in the theater Watership Down when the dog that was hunting them at one point, like, raised its leg to urinate on a telephone pole or something. Everyone, like, cheered. It's like, hey, realism!
Yay. Now let's see the bunny god again.
Okay, anything else, John?
Arc-vicious bunny god. The other book that I read was Paul Tremblay's A Head Full of Ghosts, which was just superb. I wasn't sure how I would do with it because I read a lot of weird fiction and, you know, sort of different types of outsider stuff, but I'm not a big horror reader. So I was like thinking, well, it's supposed to be quite good. I've read some of Paul's short stuff. And, you know, he seems like an interesting author. I've never read a full-length work of his, so I'll try it out. And I did, and it was really good. It was just really, not just well done, but it really hit all the notes for horror without descending into cliches. It was a sort of a remarkably fresh take on some older story forms, and it really held me. I read it in like two sittings, so it was really hooked me, and something I don't usually say about horror books is that I really appreciate the characters, and in this one, the characters were incredibly well done, so that was a really nice factor as well. So it's not just, you know, not just playing for scares or for blood, but there's a real examination of the cost of belief and the cost of, to some degree, deception that runs through the book that I thought was really, really interesting. It becomes virtually sort of part of the plot is the question of belief and what's really going on. So that was good. I was very pleased with that. And then for TV show stuff at all, I finally watched the first season of The Expanse. And it was okay. I was not as floored by The Expanse as a lot of other people were.
This podcast is over. Just kidding.
Dun, dun, dun. And then there was a show off. Showdown. Whatever. No, it was good. It was good. And they did some things that I thought were different for the kind of show it was. But there's just a point where I feel that, you know, they really start out really pushing the realism. And I think it just sort of, I felt that it kind of moved to the background as the story progressed. And it's not essential to the story, but it is a component of what's going on. And as we got more into the story, I just felt there was a step back taken from the world building, essentially.
Yeah, so, I just found it odd. Have you read the book, the first book?
I have not.
Okay. That mean we were wondering 10 episodes how they were going to get through the whole book, and they didn't. So, you know, that and they kind of brought some characters forward from the second book onwards.
Yeah, and I was fine with all that. I think I think the issue that I had, and once again I'm saying this having read the books, and I went out of my way to try to not hold it up in comparison, but there were too many sequences in the course of the series where there was tension, but there was tension without any real character building or world building. Mm-hmm. There were too many sequences where we have to connect all these wires and do this, or we have to do this, and it's a race against time.
Right.
And I said to myself, you know, when they find the stowaway and that whole thing is where they're going to be boarded or not, I was like, they could have done this in 20 minutes with the exact amount of content and moved on to another, you know, part of the story at this point. And I said at the end of episode 6, I said that could have been those 6 episodes could have been 4 episodes if they had been paced right. And I'm fine with the tension and I'm fine with seeing the inside of neat spaceships, but they were in full blown decompression mode for the first 6 or 7 before they really hit their stride when it came to pacing everything. And keeping all the balls in the air, which I thought was good. I really liked it, and I'm looking forward to the second season. But you know, I felt the same way with Sense8 last year, is that there was just far too much, far too much funny scenes or pretty scenes that really didn't, you know, they were doing single duty. Mm-hmm. They could have been doing double or triple duty.
Right.
Well, every show seems to take at least one season to find its pacing, so luckily this one did well enough so it's been renewed and being worked on, so maybe, I mean, even Babylon 5, which has got to be probably my favorite show, season 1 is weak sauce.
That's rough, yeah.
Yeah.
But season 4, oh my god, you know, so there you go.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I liked it. I'll watch the second season, but I just felt that some things fell by the wayside or were sort of stretched out. And the other thing that bothered me a little bit, which I'm still trying to decide how to respond to fully, was the way that the politics work. And especially with things like the butcher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his act of butchery, it's like, I don't see the political reason why that happened. How does that make sense in the political context of what's going on?
Mm.
I mean, so, some of the really hard stuff like that, I was like, man, people are trigger happy in the future, and they're really, really sensitive. It's like every time you see someone from Mars, they're like,
"Ugh!" Yeah, so it's like Twitter.
Twitter. Let's face it. Outer space is like Twitter. So, I'm still kind of chewing on that stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, it's something I would watch again.
Cool.
And I think that is my culture consumed.
Mm. All right, Jeff, you want me to go next, or would you like to take it?
I can go.
Okay.
So I did a little bit of catching up on some anthologies that had gone under my radar. And the first one I want to talk about is Atomic Age Cthulhu, Terrifying Tales from the Mythos Menace, edited by Brian M. Sammons and Glenn Owen Barras. This came out last year. It was the second, I believe, anthology. The first one they did was called World War Cthulhu, I believe. Yes. And these are all mythos stories taking place in the 50s and playing with a lot of 50s tropes. A lot of it was so-so, but there were a couple really good stories. I really liked The Day the Music Died by Charles Christian. And the last story, which is by the editors, is called The End of the Golden Age, and it involves the FBI hunting down some comic book artists who have been writing some unpopular books that are selling well and hot off the shelves and stuff like that. There's also a Jeffrey Thomas story in here called Bad Reception, which is pretty good. Interesting idea for an anthology. You know, certainly cute and keeps in the spirit of it. But reading this many stories playing with 1950s stuff did wear on me a little bit, but I did have a great deal of fun with it. Second anthology I read from last year was The Feminine Future, Early Science Fiction by Women Writers, which was
right.
Ashley anthology, which I did not read when it came out. And these are all public domain stories from between 1873 and 1930, which I thought was interesting because in my big panel of Sargent reread last year, reading all of her Women of Wonder series, she did not do a lot of stories collect a lot of stories prior to 1940. Mm-hmm. So this really filled a gap. I had read three of the stories that are in here and some of the other stories and indeed some of the other authors I had never heard of. Some really good stuff though. Florence McLandberg's The Automaton Ear is just fantastic. I thought that was really good. And that was from the 1873 is that story. And that was really, really good. I also read, and I'm still not quite certain why I did, Carol K. Peck's Apocryphal Tales, which I found an e-copy of a little while ago. And this is a very strange collection. This is a lot of shorter works. Most of these are from before he wrote RUR. But there is quite a bit of development as an author apparent throughout a good chunk of it. Most of this has been translated by Norma Camarada, who I have to give a huge hats off to because she did an excellent job with the translation when it came to really trying to convey the meaning of things, and I enjoyed that a great deal. I reread the first of the company novels by Cage Baker, The Garden of Eden. I may do a complete company reread. A couple of the company novellas had been part of my audio listening when I was doing my various road trips last year, and I decided to start at the beginning and reground myself in the property. And I really did like Garden of Eden, so I might, if time allows, I might try to do a reread of most of the series. Now, there is a book that came out just recently. This is actually reviewed in The Economist, and it is called The Confidence Game and Why We Fall for It Every Time, and it is by Maria Konnikova, and it is a book about confidence games and scams and stuff like that. And I didn't really learn anything new about the psychology involved, which she goes into quite a bit. But I did learn there are a lot of great stories and anecdotes about various scams and confidence games that have been played throughout history, some of which, if you tried to fictionalize, nobody would believe because they're just so outlandish. However, the interesting part for me, though, was when she's talking about how confidence games work and the psychology involved and the way that people have a need for a structure for things to make sense around, and that's why these things tend to work as well as they do, I realized I had heard a lot of this before, and after thinking about it for about half an hour, I realized a lot of the same material was covered in Lisa Crohn's Wired for Story, The Writer's Guide to Using Brain Science to Hook Readers, which came out a few years ago, I think, which is a book, a writing guidebook about how certain narrative tropes and certain tricks in storytelling push reader buttons and get them to continue reading the story. And it was kind of interesting because they both make the same point that a good story or a good lie can play us, and 9 times out of 10 it works because we want them to play us, we want them to work on us. Somehow this reinforces some understanding we have of the cosmos or something. I found it very interesting that the two books basically ran down the exact same psychological landscapes of the way people think. Only one was about writing stories and the other one was about bilking them out of their money, which could be considered the same thing, but I'll leave that to brighter minds than me to decide. One comic that I have to just rant about because it was so awful was I've been in a period right now where a lot of stuff that I have been reading, a lot of the books that I've been reading fairly regularly, have taken a bit of a dip, and it sort of all happened at once. Now on the Marvel side of things, a lot of it was post Secret Wars, which kind of, you know, everybody is still getting their footing and stuff like that. But even there, there's been some decent stuff coming out. Al Ewing is doing the New Avengers, and he's doing the Ultimates, the new version of the Ultimates. And both of them, he's playing in a very, very big sort of a cosmic background. The New Avengers, he's going back to the cancer verse and the thinly veiled Lovecraft mythos impinging, taking advantage of everything that happened in the last couple of years in the Marvel Universe and playing with it. And with the Ultimates, he's sort of getting into almost an authority territory where he's, you know, having these superheroes saying, all right, let's actually commit all our great knowledge and powers to actually fixing things. And they're not just dealing with Earth issues, they're dealing with cosmic issues. And so far, they've both been pretty good. But Al Ewing's really been firing on all cylinders when it comes to the stuff that he has been doing in the Marvel Universe. The same cannot be said for a book that came out last week called Avengers Standoff, Welcome to Pleasant Hill. This is apparently a lead-in to a spring crossover, which is going to be, I guess, occurring in the next couple months. And the idea is that after this great big giant mess that occurred with Secret Wars and the incursion of other universes into ours, the federal government via S.H.I.E.L.D. elected to try to use fragments of the shattered cosmic cube to reshape and stabilize reality. And somebody has gotten access to this information, Edward Snowden-like, and released it into the wild, and now Maria Hill is basically hunting that person down. Once we get past that prologue, we meet this guy who has amnesia walking around a town that's very reminiscent of both Mayberry and the village from The Prisoner. And you can see the writing on the wall from page 2 that we know where this is going. The question is just what actually happened. And yes, sure enough, it turns out that S.H.I.E.L.D. has built this lovely little town where it's keeping all of its super criminals by giving them amnesia and having them live somebody else's life. And it's just awful. You go, there are so many holes in this plan from page 2, even to the utterly jaded comic book reader like myself. I was like, this is, it's written by Nick Spencer. The art is by Mark Bagley. The art's actually fairly good on it. And Scott Hanna's inking is excellent. But this is just a mess. This makes no sense. No sense at all. Even Fred, who at times has to grasp and struggle with all the baggage that the Marvel Comics universe brings with it, even I'd be able to hear his eye rolls from here if he was reading this. Utterly ridiculous. I don't know where this is going to go, but I don't think it's going to go anywhere good. Which is kind of too bad, because, you know, they've had an opportunity here to sort of sprint out of the gate after Secret Wars. And I commend Marvel for going out of their way to try to take chances with stuff like Squirrel Girl and the Vision miniseries, which is currently going, which is certainly not what anyone expected it to be. And a lot of the other, you know, the new Captain Marvel book that's going on, and they're really endeavoring to sort of widen the aperture when it comes to what their house style is like. However, when you have things like Rocket Raccoon and Groot and the new Drax book and Squirrel Girl and Ms. Marvel and all of these books that are, as I've complained about before, a lot of people running around making wisecracks from page to page, that tone, you start to get a little tone deaf from it. And I'll see where this goes. They're also trying to, As I mentioned with what John said about Midnighter, they're trying to scale some aspects of the Marvel Universe back, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just kind of odd editorially when you see someone like Al Ewing, who's really going out of his way to throw open the doors to everything else that's going on. But at the same time, you see, things like Hawkeye and even some of the stuff they're doing in Inhumans now. And that's the other thing, from a totally editorial thing, this whole division between the Inhumans and the X-Men, because of the Terrigen Mist, it's Marvel's attempt to sort of minimize the X-Men right now because they don't have the movie rights and things like this. And other bits that they're doing just kind of are a little bit confusing right now. And I'm still unclear what happened to the Fantastic Four, to be honest with you, and it hasn't really been addressed. But it's really too bad, because they could have come out of this really, really strong, and there's hints of it there. It's just not where I thought it would be. Also, just this week, just today, issue 2 of Karnak by Ellis, which is the story of one of the Inhumans. Issue 1 came out, oh good lord, 8 months ago, and then they put it on hold while they did Secret Wars. That finally rolled back in, and that made me fairly happy. But we're getting books like the Illuminati, and there was a new Power Man Iron Fist, which once again had very sketchy art and tried to be a very sort of funny take on things. And it's just, like I said, I'm getting tone deaf with a lot of the ways they're pulling this up. There are some genuinely funny books. The Howling Commandos of S.H.I.E.L.D. I thought has been hilarious. And there was one other one that really had me laughing. I forget what it was, but it's just, you know, I want to see what it is that they're going to try to pull off here, because they really need to tighten up. And given how DC is kind of being a tiny bit more conservative with their properties and their approaches lately, even though they're in much worse financial shape, I'm just kind of curious as to how long this is going to be kept up. I mean, you know, Hercules and Howard the Duck and all of these, you know, fairly humorous books, you know. I mean, there's more humor books coming out of Marvel than there are out of Archie comics these days, and that's saying a lot. So, one other thing, Clean Room, which is the other Gail Simone book, the kind of weird science fictional horror book that's out, that's been really good. I'm waiting to see where it's going to go before I...
Yeah, I gotta pick that up.
Yeah, that's been pretty, I think they're at four issues now, I think we're up to. Yeah, that's been pretty tight. When I talked about, you know, the books that are just kind of dipping for me, it's little things that sort of happen, like this last issue of the Star Wars comic really felt like it was a Marvel comic from about 5 or 6 years ago. There was a big space prison and there was, you know, all this, you know, stuff going on. It felt like one of the Dan Abnett, Andy Lanning, you know, books mm-hmm. from around the time of the Annihilation miniseries that they did, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just kind of odd, you know, when you get a true Marvel vibe out of a Star Wars book, it's kind of a tiny bit confusing. but even that, the third issue of Lucifer, I thought was a tiny bit of a drop in quality. Unfollow sort of went down. I haven't read the new saga. From Under Mountains, by the way, which is up to issue 5. I've mentioned that before, by Gibson and Long. That's been really good. Really neat little fantasy story. So it's just been, I'm just kind of reassessing a lot of the books right now, and you know, everyone seems to be floundering. 2016 does not seem to have a theme when it comes to comics right now. And, which is kind of too bad, because there's been a lot of really good properties, you know, stuff like Postal and Injection, which has been great. Warren Ellison's, Injection has been fantastic, and the new Manhattan Projects book. There's a lot of good stuff happening right now, but Marvel is just, I don't want to say they're floundering, but they're on unsure footing right now. So, and is that everything for me? Yeah, that's about it for me. So,
wow. Okay. Well, as usual, we will provide show links to my year in books, my year in shorts, as well as a new list I'm keeping, my year in active listens, which is all the podcasts I'm currently subscribed to.
Ooh.
Something like 85 different podcasts, so I might have a problem. Recent things, I'm in the middle of running a multi-session but relatively short adventure for Call of Cthulhu with a group of friends, which started out by them learning that they were going to go investigate a haunted house, and they're like, hey, haunted house, we've got this. We've done this before. No problem. And then they first up call up about 30 ghouls, and then they call up an elder god by the name of Ugolanok. And as they say, hilarity ensued. So I'll be interested to see what happens in the second session. Along those lines, I actually think my Cthulhu adventure was better than most of the new X-Files episodes that have run. Quite honestly, I've only liked one of the episodes completely all the way through. A second episode had some amusing bits. Third episode had some nice scary bits, but echoed earlier original X-Files, and the two bookends done by Chris Carter. Well, whatever. Not that. Neither were that good, so, unfortunately. We have moved into the world of spies locally. We watched the Alec Guinness versions of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and Smiley's People. And I tell you, Alec Guinness was, he was wasted in Star Wars. Wasted. I mean, he's so good in these miniseries. And that led me to get a Call for the Dead by John Le Carre. That's the first George Smiley book, which I just finished. I also read, I think the problem is last year I read so much that this year I'm having a hard time starting, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So along your lines of both of you, I have cut out probably about half of the titles that I was buying from for comics. I really only kept the ones I liked, you know, that I would read as soon as they came out, or the ones my daughter has been reading steadily, which does include some of those titles that I read. But for the most part, probably aiming more towards trades for some of the titles that got rebooted, because, like you say, Jeff, just not feeling the vibe right now.
I think for me, part of it is that I've dropped quite a few titles, but the titles that I'm hanging on to because I'm kind of curious how deep of a hole can they dig? You know, I read comics fairly fast, mm-hmm. and I will go back and sort of gaze on the art if it's worth gazing at.
Yeah.
But so much of what Marvel's doing right now, the art has been there to basically tell the story and not really dazzle us. And with a few, notable exceptions, and all the art has definitely been worth it. There's very few books that I would say have bad art. There's art that I'm not a big fan of, but I certainly wouldn't say it's bad. There's certainly a lot of craftsmanship involved, but I read a book like the new Power Man Iron Fist that came out, and I'm like, okay, is it going to be this every issue? And if I get another issue of the one note that they keep hitting over and over again, I'll probably drop it pretty quickly. But
I think I just got burned out on Capes and Tights. So the ones that excite me are more like the Injections or Trees or, things like that. So I'll get trades on some of the superhero titles that I've dropped when they come out, just to see if it was worth, if it's worth bringing them back later on, I'll bring them back. I'll resubscribe. But, they were piling up faster than I was reading, faster than I was reading. I'm like, they'll be around.
Yeah, that's true. One thing real quick. Third issue just came out. Tim Truman and what is his name? Tom Giarello were doing Wolves Beyond the Border, King Conan Wolves Beyond the Border. Three issues have been out, and it's been one of the better Conan books in the last two or three years. I really liked it. So,
The burnout has spread into reading. So, for example, I've only read 5 books for the year to date so far, which means I'm going slower. I used to be doing it more, at least mm-hmm. a book a week. Mm-hmm. So the only 2 books I've read since our last show, other than the books I read for, our interview tonight, 1632 by Eric Flint, which is part of his Ring of Fire universe. And I read that just because it's such a fun series and I am way behind in the titles on that, so I wanted to start working towards that again. And then the John Le Carre. On short stories, I'm doing better. I've done 32 or so, maybe 35 short stories so far for the year. And right now, in addition to various new anthologies or multi-author anthologies, like the Jonathan Strawn anthology that I'm reading, I am doing a lot of older stuff. So I started rereading Conan, mostly because of that Twitter feed, Conan the Salaryman. I don't know if you've seen that.
That's funny.
Which is so hilarious, and you know, I wanted to read the stories again. I am rereading Elric by Michael Moorcock, because I'm one of the things I might do once this Call of Cthulhu adventure is done and another guy runs his adventure, Paul Weimer, is going to run some stuff. I might visit Stormbringer, the role-playing game.
Yeah.
Or I might go to RuneQuest. Either way, it's the same system, so
exactly.
You know, wanted to get Elric going. And I'm still reading that Alan Steele Sex and Violence in Outer Space that I mentioned last time. And I'm reading two Fritz Lieber collections. One is the first Fafford and Gray Mouser series book, just because they're classics. And a lot of his short stories, his non-Fafford short stories, have been put out in ebook. So I've been, you know, I collected a bunch of them. I want to work through those because he's been kind of scattershot for me over the years. I mean, I had I think it was called The Best of Fritz Lieber growing up, a couple of collections here and there. There was his Ghostlight collection, which if anybody ever sees that, grab it because that is like,
mm-hmm.
Fantastic collection, especially the long autobiographical essay in the back. And especially try to get the trade paperback or the hardcover, if there was one, I can't remember, that was illustrated, because the illustrations are fantastic. So, you know, I've kind of read short stories of his here and there, but this is the first time I've seen, like, you know, between a couple of, I think it was a Nightshade did a set, and I think Subterranean did a set, you know, so between a couple of those and these ebooks, I think we finally have a good picture of his short story output. Mm. So I want to work through those this year. But like I said, you know, so far this year I've been kind of not feeling the urge to read.
I'm it's weird because I've been trying to moderate my reading a bit, but what'll happen is I'll have a week where two or three books will appear that I just have to read these. You know, two that just came up. John Ray has a book out called The Lost Time Accidents, which got a fairly good review in Locus, and I want to read that. And I just got a copy of Medusa's Web by Tim Powers, which I'm going to have to read.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, he's mandatory. Alistair Reynolds' new book, that's a mandatory. You know, I mean, there's a lot of books that I'm going to read. I just, between family stuff, work stuff, and just like energy levels, I'm like,
No, I hear it. The other thing that, something else that leaped to mind, same thing with last year where I'll remember a scene or I'll remember a sequence and I'll go back and I'll find it and I'll read it. And of course, as soon as I read that sequence, I want to reread the whole book. Something I have not read in a while is Tea from an Empty Cup by Pat Cadigan. And, I was trying to find a particular sequence in that book, and I found it, and of course ended up reading the whole chapter and said, damn it, now I have to read this whole thing. So I closed it and put it aside, and I will get to it. That'll also be on my reread list for this this year.
Well, now that's interesting, because I've been a little slower this year, too. But, I mean, I actually, for the first time in several years last year, made my reading goal for the year, and this year I'm already behind, but I think what Fred was saying about, you know, stuff, I'm actually working on this project that I'm working on is taking up a lot of time and energy, so there's a little less time to read,
right?
You know, and that's kind of what it seems to come down to, is that, you know, I look at the clock and I'm like, oh, it's 10:30. I can read for half an hour, and then I.
Well,
anyway,
something else for me is that, well, you know, what Fred was talking about last year about trying to read more nonfiction, I've actually managed to do that. I mean, aside from the Konnikova book, I read Tim Whitmarsh's Battling the Gods, which was about religious upheavals in the classical world. And I read Of Societies and Men by Carol Haskins. I read it because it had a foreword by Vannevar Bush, who I've had a bit of a weird historical crush on lately.
Okay then.
Well, just because his idea for what eventually became the internet.
Oh yes, yes.
What his idea was, and even though he got almost the entire mechanism of it incorrect, its actual function as an informational tool he nailed. And so I'm still kicking myself because I found a copy of the book he wrote about machines of the future at one of the antique stores near me, and I had picked it up and I'd probably read about 50 pages of it, but they were just asking way too much for it, and I put it down and I kept going back and it was gone like the following week. I'm kicking myself for that. But yeah, I've been digging into a lot of, rather historical nonfiction. A lot of it's been just for research purposes, for the stuff I'm writing. Henry Beach was another one. Rational Man by Henry Beach was another really good one. And reading these sort of philosophical history books that all came out immediately after World War II is kind of a neat experience in just the way that a lot of worldviews were being taken, the way that a lot of writers were approaching how societies work in the wake of, World War II is just rather fascinating. And I actually am hoping I can find some decent books about post-war. I was reminded a lot of Walter John Williams' The Praxis, where everybody talks about what happened the last time there was great struggle and conflict, and nobody really wants to get too deeply involved in another one. And I started seeing reflections of that kind of mindset and a lot of stuff that I was looking at. So I'm kind of reading with a theme this year when it rises up. So.
Oh, that's well, actually post World War II. That reminds me. I did acquire something interesting the other day. I found a book called Japanese Militarism, which was autographed by the author. But the reason I bought it was that it was autographed or signed by the previous owner, some guy named Lenny Barger.
Wow.
Okay.
Paul Anthony.
Wow.
So that means I now own two books signed by science fiction's own Cordwainer Smith, but in his guise as a real person in his professional life.
Wow.
So I'm wondering whether this bookseller will email me in a couple of days saying, oh, I researched who that Paul Lindberger was, and I should have asked you for more money, because that happened the last time I got one. It's like, sorry, buddy.
Well, exactly. It's like, you should have thought of that. Well, like today, I was going through some books here, and I found just randomly two signed books.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody super. I mean, like Jessica Salmonson and Martin Greenberg, they signed an anthology.
Wow.
But, that's, yeah. They signed, what is it, Blood Muse, Timeless Tales of Vampires in the Arts.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever seen that many Greenberg autographs.
Yeah, I gotta do a little more research on it. But man, you gotta be careful.
Yeah. Yep.
You're gonna...
Hey, his loss, my gain.
Yeah.
So,
my wife used to say that she would go on to eBay and look up specific books she was looking for, and she would purposely misspell the author's name about 20 different ways, because she found multiple times she found items on eBay where somebody had put the spelling in incorrectly, and that's why nobody had bid on it. So.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So, final thoughts.
I think we've said enough.
And if not us, our guests.
Yes, so, there's plenty of talk this time around.
Hope everybody enjoyed our first, maybe our only, two-part episode. Until the next time we get David Weber lassoed, maybe. And we'll see you next month.
Yep.
So, good night, all.
Good night.
Good night.